There's a new neighbor in town. The Lutheran Federal Credit Union is open and ready to serve members of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Lutheran Federal Credit Union provides checking and savings accounts, home, car, and personal loans, on-demand mobile banking, 30,000 ATMs, and 5,000 in the co-op shared network. You'll find the modernized banking experience you need with excellent customer service and security you expect at LutheranFCU.org. LutheranFCU.org.
So I've taken the position, which is quite common among Catholics. I got a personal feeling about abortion, but the right rule for government is to let women make their own decisions.
Well, I'm going to ask him the same question that Lincoln put to Stephen Douglas, who essentially argued the same thing on slavery. Douglas said he was personally opposed to slavery, but thought each state should have the right to vote it up or down. So here's the question. Mr. Kane, why are you personally opposed?
Selective outrage. I know that I need to be mad because something wrong has happened. And that's true. But the last thing I'm going to do is have ownership of the problem as if I'm part of it.
New dads like fixing the issues, etc.
The story, of course, is deeply tragic. One man's death, others were injured, but the man who died while performing his responsibilities as a Catholic priest near the end of a mass at a church there in France. It's made national news. It has a symbolic import to it. A Catholic priest celebrating mass, murdered by knife-wielding Muslims who were later dispatched, so to speak, on the steps of the church after yelling as they exit the church, "Allahu Akbar, Allah is great." Oddly, the reporting on that story initially said that the motive for these heinous acts was unknown. What does that tell us about how the reporting was being done? Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in live on this Wednesday afternoon, the 27th of July. Terry Mattingly will join us, founder and editor of GetReligion.org. We'll be talking about media coverage of the murder of a Catholic priest in France a little bit later. We'll talk about the Democratic Convention. Molly Hemingway, senior editor for The Federalist, will be our guest. Ordinarily, she joins us with Mark Hemingway, but he's reporting on a protest outside the Democratic National Convention. We'll be talking with Molly, getting her take on the first couple days of that event. You can join us with your questions, thoughts, and comments, 1-877-623-6943. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org. Send us a tweet at issuesetc. The Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8382. Joining us to talk about media coverage of the murder of a priest in France, Terry Mattingly, Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate, and founder and editor of GetReligion.org. Terry, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Glad to be here.
How do you explain the original reporting via Twitter, I believe the outlet was The Telegraph, that the motives of the attackers of this small group of Catholics, including their priest in France, were unknown?
This is a really strange one. I mean, I heard from readers who said they saw this in television reports as well early on, that at places like BBC and other major networks, they saw references to the attackers' motives being unknown. First of all, it's important to emphasize that we're talking about the very early coverage. In the internet age, lots of people do what they call write-throughs, and where people used to like leave up the old versions of their stories so that you could watch the development of the story. Lately, more and more news organizations have been taking down the early drafts, the early versions of their stories, and replacing them with later ones. So it's hard to confirm what they actually published initially unless someone does a screen grab, literally takes a digital image of what was on the site, you know, when it originally was published. My theory on this one is twofold. First of all, I mean, you know me, I always try to come up with a positive reason and a negative reason. Or let's say we say not a positive reason, but a valid excuse. A lot of our major publications, even the New York Times, they're simply working with a lot fewer international staff than they used to. whereas they had bureaus formerly in a lot of major cities. Even an organization as important as, say, CBS News may only have one or two reporters based in London, and these people have to fly out to get to major news, which, as you could understand, would shape your early coverage, you know, extensively. But what if, at the same time, your newsroom had a policy that you tried to do all of your own reporting, and you tried not to quote information from other publications by name, because that's kind of embarrassing if you're working at the Washington Post or the Associated Press or the New York Times, and you have to say, according to a report in Le Monde, the following thing happened. You'd much rather have your own information. I think that listeners can understand that. So to some degree, they're working with less material than they used to be able to gather on the scene through their own staff. So that puts them in a position where they're basically waiting for official people, agencies, police, politicians. You're waiting for them to put out a statement so that you have someone to quote other than publications that are closer and on the scene. But none of this fits the Telegraph in the sense that that's a British newspaper, and I would assume a British newspaper has pretty good sources there in Europe itself. This brings us to the second part of this. You and I have talked many, many times about this kind of state of mind that a lot of journalists have, which is that political things are real and everything else is not so real, especially this mysterious and strange world of religion. So with that being the case, to some degree, there are journalists who may not think, well, we don't know what happened in that church until the police or government officials tell us. So my theory for this that I put in the post today at Get Religion, my theory is to some degree when a journalist made a statement or wrote a statement like, the attacker's motives are still unknown. Still unknown being the words that ran infamously at the Telegraph. Part of what I think that means to the journalist who's writing it is the police and the politicians have not told us on the record what the motive is. So what's the alternative? Well, the alternative in this case is you actually report evidence from what happened on the scene. And then you, to some degree, let the readers draw their own conclusions. What made the Telegraph story so bizarre is that, to some degree, it appeared they had done that. Let me read you a little bit of a screen grab from the early draft of the Telegraph story, the one that went wild on Twitter. Police have shot dead two men who took a priest and several others hostage at knife point at a church northwest of France. The men shouted Daesh and cut the priest's throat before being neutralized, police said. Okay, Daesh is a term used to describe the Islamic State. So you have people attacking and shouting an identification with the Islamic State. You have other very early reports already in print saying that they were shouting Allahu Akbar, you know, and that there were other signs that these were radicalized Muslims attacking. And then you have the symbolic gesture of the attempt to behead him, was how some people worded it. Instead of just slitting his throat, they said it was an attempt to behead him. So after you've said Daesh, after you've said his throat being cut, the very next words after a short quote, kind of a repetitive thing, the fourth paragraph says, the men's motives are still unclear. Now, that really mystified people. I mean, what else do you need to know about this scene that might indicate to you what their motives were? And sure enough, as the day went on, you had all kinds of things surface while the Telegraph and some places were still using that language. You had things like this church was on an ISIS hit list. You had descriptions of the men. You had the fact that one of them had already tried to go to Syria twice and was supposed to be wearing an electronic bracelet on his ankle, you know, so that he could be traced as a potential terrorist by the police. there's the poignant detail that in his the terms of his house arrest, so to speak, he was allowed to move around in the city at random between 8:30 a.m. and 12:30 p.m. And of course, the mass that he attacked was at 9 a.m. So we have a priest killed in an attack on a mass. You have nuns and other worshipers seized and one nun critically injured. You have shouts of identification both with a radicalized form of Islam and is the Islamic State. You have all of these details, and you're trying to combine them with the phrase, the men's motives are still unknown. It's a pretty mysterious and weird case. But like I said, I think what the journalists meant when they typed that was, public officials have not told us on the record that this is ISIS. I think that's what that sentence meant, but it's sure not what they wrote.
They could have said something else. They could have said, no group officially claims responsibility. Or they could have said, officials still determining motive. That would have been a factual statement if, in fact, the officials were still determining
motive. Well, but some of the earliest reports noted that ISIS started celebrating immediately. Now, of course, ISIS celebrates anything, you know, that's horrible. You know, when it comes to terror in the name of, you know, of a radicalized Islam. So to some degree, ISIS claiming responsibility is something you can certainly quote, but it's not definitive. So I would even draw a distinction between journalists being comfortable with ISIS saying something and the fact that journalists have a tendency to think that what police and what politicians say is real, and everything else, especially religious material, is kind of not so real. Once again, I think that's what's going on.
Terry Mattingly is our guest. We're talking about media coverage of the murder of a Catholic priest in France. An illustrative story from his journalism school days after this. Temptation, promiscuity, marriage, homosexuality. These are some of the issues addressed in the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July, Sexual Morality in a Christless World. You can read an excerpt at issuesetc.org or find out more by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Learn the truth about sexual morality from a reasoned Christian perspective with the Issues Etc. Book of the Month, Sexual Morality in a Christless World.
Have you been too busy to get your associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree? Concordia University, Wisconsin offers 50 online educational options. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Click the Concordia University online logo and enter the program code ISSUES to waive your application fee. Concordia University, Wisconsin is here to strengthen and support the church. Lifelong Lutheran learning. issuesetc.org and click Concordia University, Wisconsin online.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Luther says, from the fact that prayer is so urgently commanded, you ought to conclude that we should by no means despise our prayers, but rather praise them highly.
Pastor Jonathan Fisk speaking at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
This is an act of obedience, he says. On this I rely and depend and revere it highly because of the commandment. But he also says, God has made and affirmed a promise with the Lord's Prayer that what we pray is certain and a sure thing. All that stuff that you don't want, that the Spirit compels you to pray for when you pray the Lord's Prayer, is a sure thing to be answered true, concluding on the last day, of course, but already present through faith alone in Christ.
You can listen to Pastor Fisk's presentation, Making the Case for the Lord's Prayer, in an audio DVD from the 2016 Making the Case Conference for a donation of $300. We'll send you this audio DVD. For more information, look for the DVD logo at issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin, talking with Terry Mattingly, Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College New York City, about media coverage of the murder of a Catholic priest in France. Pick up where we left off, Terry. You actually have an illustrative story from your J-School days, one of your professors there, advice that he gave that still holds true for reporters in cases like this.
Yeah, that's one of the things that this provocative question today brought to mind. When I was very young, and I was literally a sophomore in college and was in an introductory reporting class, my mentor, the great journalism professor David McCam at Baylor, and then he went on to teach at SMU and the University of Houston. And I'm proud to say I recently got to attend a ceremony where he was honored as one of the outstanding graduates at the Columbia School of Journalism in New York City. Although he was very much a Southerner, he went up there to get his master's degree and do some work. McCam told us in that early class that there's a way to tell veteran reporters from rookie or inexperienced reporters when you cover some sort of tragedy or event like a tornado or a murder or a multiple car crash or something like that. When you arrive at the scene, a rookie, an inexperienced reporter, arrives at the scene, and more than anything else, they're scared to make a mistake. So they tend to arrive and say, "Where's the police?" Or even more, they may ask, "Where is the public information officer for the police department?" In other words, where are the people who are preparing the official police department government report? Who's doing the written statement? Who's doing the documents? That's what a rookie does because that's the most authoritative information that they think exists. And to some degree, they're being safe. They're scared of making a mistake. He said, but experienced reporters, they know that police have phone numbers and police information officers are paid to return your call. You can call them when you get back to the office. You can look them up later. They're not hard to reach. He said, the experienced reporter shows up at the scene, looks around, finds the crowd, and quietly, discreetly starts walking through the crowd going, okay, who saw what happened? And what McCam was saying was that when you're at an event of this kind, there may be people there who saw things, in some cases, that they don't want to tell the police, or they're scared to be identified, or maybe they're just no one's asked them any questions yet. And I remember him distinctly saying that scared kid over there behind a tree may not ever talk to the police, but he may have seen the whole thing. If you can get him to talk, you'll have information no one else has. Or that woman on a porch nearby crying who just happened to be walking her dog and saw the entire accident or saw the entire gang shooting or whatever, she may not end up in the police report either. And if you don't find her at that moment, she's gone, or that kid is gone. You have no second chance to talk to them. So in the early reporting about this event in France, by the way, since I don't speak French, I did not realize that the name of the town and the name of the church where this took place, take a guess what saint the church is dedicated to.
What is it?
Saint Stephen.
Hmm.
So this martyrdom took place in the Church of St. Stephen. The early reporting on this event, the elite publications quoted lots of police and government officials and whatever. What we would, some would even call the tabloid or the more conservative or you might even say more religion-friendly newspapers, they quoted eyewitnesses. They quoted people who said they saw what happened, or this is what I heard, or whatever. Now, are eyewitnesses always right? Of course not. But I have news for you. Police reports are not always right either, especially not initially. Why not ask the people who were there what they saw and heard? And then eventually, of course, we even had the testimony of a nun who managed to escape the sanctuary, saw what happened and then was able to escape without being held hostage. And her details were just extremely gripping and confirmed everything else that people had said before. Especially poignant is they apparently, this occurred at the end of a mass, as best we can tell. They interrupted the mass. So here you have a priest, fully vested, I assume, standing at his altar. They come and they force him to kneel at the altar and kill him. And then one of the men apparently went to the pulpit and delivered some sort of oration in Arabic. At least least that's the testimony of the nun who managed to escape. Now, I'm Eastern Orthodox. I'm not Roman Catholic. But during the Bolshevik Revolution, a lot of people, the communists, one of their favorite hellish acts was to kill a priest on his own altar, which desecrates it. And the church would then have to be rededicated by the bishop. There would be a lengthy amount of rituals. And, of course, they're killing the bishops, too. I do not know if they desecrated this altar with the priest's blood. I do not know if in Catholic theology the area around the altar is considered part of the altar. In Orthodoxy, you frequently will hear someone say, well, he said that as he stood on the altar. And, of course, they don't mean standing on the table on the altar. They mean he was standing at the altar. But the area around it is called on the altar. So I don't know the Catholic theology here, but I'm going to try to find out. Because a kind of a debate is already breaking out among some Roman Catholics over the fact whether this was a deliberate act of religious hatred, and thus, did this priest die because of the hatred of the faith? Does this automatically make him a martyr? Now, the Archbishop of Sydney, Australia, has already taken a very powerful act, which he immediately went straight to Twitter and said, tomorrow I will celebrate the Mass for the age of persecution in honor of this man, in honor of this priest tomorrow. And this archbishop made it very clear with a lengthy kind of litany of reasons why that he believed this was an act of martyrdom. Very powerful stuff.
So along with that, that's an obvious follow-up here. What other follow-ups would a good reporter paying attention want to pursue?
Well, you'd want to know if anybody's going to do that in America. There have been bishops calling for fasting. And, of course, all of this is taking place during what for the modern Catholic Church is kind of the young Catholic Woodstock, which is World Youth Day. And everybody wants to know what the Pope will or will not do to somehow kind of note this. I'm also intrigued to see if journalists will note one of the best known Muslims in the American media. At least it was someone whose byline I knew and had read things by him in the past, is a Wall Street Journal editorial columnist, feature writer, and commenter who's currently based in Europe. And he's Iranian by heritage and Muslim. And his name, if I can pronounce it correct, is Sohrab Ahmari, S-O-H-R-A-B, last name A-H-M-A-R-I. And today on Twitter, he tweeted something that would hard to be much more powerful in the length of a tweet. You, of course, remember, I am Charlie Hebdo. You know, the phrase that everyone used when the satirical magazine was attacked. And you saw that all over the world, I am Charlie Hebdo. The opening of his tweet is hashtag I am Yaks Hamel. And then he says, in fact, this is the right moment to announce that I'm converting to Roman Catholicism.
Wow.
Under the instruction of the London Oratory, which is one of the most famous sites for traditional Christianity, traditional Catholic Christianity in London. So I would say that that's a rather dramatic act. I'm kind of anxious to find out whether there will be any stories on that tomorrow in the Wall Street Journal or anywhere else. I am Jacques Hamel.
I'd like to think that this story, at least from my perception of it, is, and we hear about Christians being beheaded, martyred, killed in Islamic areas on a daily basis, moving into Europe, of course, but nothing so targeted, nothing so pointed as a priest at the altar. Does this story have a special symbolic value that journalists ought to be aware of?
Well, I mean, like I said, there are still all kinds of individual questions about the act itself that I don't think have been answered, and yet they have tremendous importance to Roman Catholics. And the world contains a couple of Roman Catholics. I mean, that's a large audience just right there. If you're in a major urban area, pretty much anywhere in the Western world, and now in parts of the Third World as well. The fact that Catholic readers would be interested in this alone would justify pretty intense follow-ups. You know, I can think of all kinds of stories, but then again, I'm terribly motivated to do so, and I'm very interested in it. Another example, technical question, but just stop and think about the symbolism of this. It's tradition that when a Catholic or Orthodox priest dies, he is buried in his vestments. Now, I'm not sure which vestments those are in terms of liturgical season or whatever, but in this case, we're dealing with a priest who died in his vestments. Will he now be buried in the same vestments? I mean, I think that's poignant. I'm also interested, just another thing that I think the press should be following up on. These men were said to have videotaped this act. Now, the two men were shot and killed outside. Did they videotape that and broadcast it to the cloud? In other words, is there a video somewhere that actually tells us what happened at that altar and even tells us what was said? Or is that something that is now in the possession of police and we may never know? I can just go on and on with these angles. I don't think we're done reporting this story.
Terry Mattingly, Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City, author of the weekly On Religion column from the Universal Syndicate and founder and editor of GetReligion.org. Terry, thank you very much.
Glad to be here.
Folks, be sure to check out the fall online classes offered by Concordia University, Wisconsin. They offer 50 online educational options for an associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree. You can find out more at issuesetc.org. Click the Concordia University, Wisconsin online logo. Enter the promo code ISSUES, and they'll waive your application fee. Lifelong Lutheran Learning, Concordia University, Wisconsin online. When we come back, we're going to talk about the Democratic Convention still underway. Molly Hemingway, senior editor for The Federalist, will be our guest.
Confessional, liturgical, sacramental. Lutheran Church of the Redeemer is located in Columbus, Georgia, right next to Fort Benning, Georgia, off of Exit 7 on I-185. Come receive our Lord Jesus' gifts of forgiveness and grace every Sunday in the Divine Service. For more information, visit our website, RedeemerColumbusGA.org.
There are nearly 20 million college students in the United States. 40% will stop going to church during college. 50% will never return. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is seeking to meet this challenge through LCMSU. Why? Because 100% of college students matter to God and to His church. College is tough. You need Jesus. We'll help. LCMSU. Check us out at lcms.org/lcmsu.
Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville, Illinois, engages young adults in a Christ-centered environment, delivering academic excellence and spiritual growth to develop Christian leaders for tomorrow. We provide a Christ-focused alternative to public high schools. Many of our students receive tuition assistance. To help us provide tuition assistance to more students, go to melhs.org and click on the giving page, or call me, Dr. J. Krause, principal, at 618-656-0043.
In my family, education means cultivating wisdom and virtue by teaching what is good, true, and beautiful. Memoria Press makes this type of education possible with their classical Christian curriculum. Characterized by simplicity, quality, and affordability, Memoria Press gives my children a rich classical education. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Does your confessional Lutheran nonprofit or church need a new website? Let WordSites help you for free. WordSites is a volunteer-led group of technology and marketing gurus who have come together to help their fellow Lutherans. With the support of an effective website, you can clearly proclaim Christ and Him crucified to the digital world that we live in. To submit your organization for consideration, or to learn more, visit wordsites.org. WordSites, your confessional Lutheran website, reformed.
Your pastor has been called to shepherd you as a member of Christ's flock. Doxology offers an innovative program of advanced study retreats where your pastor can be refreshed, renewed, and refocused. Find out more at doxology.us. Many pastors report that doxology has been one of the most valuable learning experiences since seminary. Doxology, the Lutheran Center for Spiritual Care and Counsel. Doxology.us. Doxology.us.